while. But he had been seen in Portland recently, and nobody knew exactly why. Part 6. A Civil Matter. Chapter 47. Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge Anser Haggerty was something of a legend. Like almost every other male connected to the Cunningham case, Haggerty was an athlete. He had grown up in North Portland and played guard for the University of Oregon, where he had been All-Pac-10. He had served as a Marine captain in Vietnam. In fact, Haggerty and Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schrunk had gone through officers' training together. Haggerty, wounded in battle, was highly decorated for valor. Haggerty was a massive presence in a courtroom, standing over 6 feet 2 inches tall, weighing in somewhere around 260. He had a wry sense of humor and a quick wit, but he had never looked favorably on defendants who simply ignored the justice system, as Brad Cunningham apparently intended to do. The trial was going ahead whether he was present at the defense table or not. By May 6, 1991, a jury had been selected. Charlene Fort, a science teacher, was elected foreman of the 12-member panel, which was equally divided between males and females. Before testimony began, the jurors were taken for a jury view of the intersection of 79th and the Sunset Highway so they could visualize the physical dimensions of all they would hear in the weeks ahead. They knew, of course, that something of great importance to this case had happened there. They did not yet know what. Mike Shin did, and he had a prickly feeling at the back of his neck and along his spine as he stood looking at the spot where Cheryl's body had been discovered. "I hate to admit it," he said, "but I couldn't help but wonder if someone was back in those trees taking a bead on me." The trial began the next day. Judge Haggerty's courtroom looked like all courtrooms. He sat behind the bench in black robes beneath the state seal of Oregon, the American flag on his right, the flag of Oregon on his left. Shin was at the table of the complaining party, John Burke representing the estate of Cheryl Keaton, who was not present. Diane Baker sat beside Shin, her long blonde hair caught back and falling to her waist. Cheryl's relatives and friends sat in the back of the courtroom, but somehow the usual air of excitement was missing. There was no one at the defense table. No defendant. No defense attorneys. As Shin would comment later, "It was like playing tennis by yourself. There was no one to return my serves." Before the jury filed in to hear testimony, Shin detailed for Judge Haggerty the arduous steps he had taken to locate Bradley Cunningham, listing the names of all Brad's previous attorneys whom he had notified of the trial date. He also said he had taken a deposition from Trudy Dreesen, Brad's aunt in Linwood, Washington. Mrs. Dreesen acknowledged to Shin that she talked to Brad at least once a week. "She begged me not to depose her," Shin told the judge, "but I had to." Trudy Dreesen, who was now terribly ill, admitted that she had talked to Brad the morning of her deposition and informed him that his trial was due to start in Portland within 2 weeks. Shin told of hiring Charles Pollard, who is one of the best investigators in Texas and claims he can find anyone in 24 hours. Pollard had found Dana Malloy and Jess, Michael, and Philip Cunningham. He had not found Brad Cunningham. He had hand-delivered Judge Haggerty's order to trial to Dana Malloy 1 week before the trial. Whether Pollard ever saw Cunningham wasn't really the point. Brad had clearly gotten the message. Within 2 days, Brad, Dana, and the three little boys had vacated their lavish fortress of a home in Houston. "No one knows where Brad Cunningham is now," Shin said flatly. The jury then filed in to hear the story of Cheryl Keaton's tragically short life and to listen to the witnesses Shin had gathered to help him tell it. He held up a large picture of Cheryl. She was wearing a tan trench coat, and she was smiling through raindrops at the cameraman. Ironically, the photographer had been the man Shin alleged had killed her, Brad Cunningham. In 1986, Cheryl Keaton was 34 or so, Shin began softly. As you can see, she was a beautiful woman. She had a brilliant future ahead of her. She was a woman who played many difficult roles at the same time. First of all, she was the mother of these three little boys. He held up another picture. It was a heartbreaker. Cheryl with Jess, Michael, and Philip. In 1986, the oldest, Jess, was 6. Michael was 4, and the youngest, Philip, was 2 years old. The jury next looked at a photograph of a laughing woman clinging to a darkly handsome, smiling man as they stepped through a doorway toward their future together. She was the wife of this man, Bradley Morris Cunningham, Shin said. This was taken on their wedding day. She thought at the time she was his second wife. She later found out she was his fourth. It hadn't been difficult to pick a jury who knew nothing of the case. There had been little coverage of Cheryl's death, and she had been dead for almost 5 years. Who were these people? Shin asked. Mr. Cunningham was one of the most intriguing personalities you are ever likely to encounter. He had a charm about him, a charisma. Could Shin do it? Could he paint a true picture of a man the jury was likely never to see? Could he bring Cheryl back to life and make her real enough for the jury to understand how devastating her murder had been to so many people? Could he explain why there was something fundamentally disastrous about their relationship? Would the preponderance of the evidence he presented to the jury prove that Brad had murdered his wife? Shin began almost at the end of Cheryl's life, setting up an enlargement of Cheryl's last will and testament on the easel in front of the jury. He described the tearing hurry Cheryl had been in to have a new will drawn up, a will barring her husband from inheriting her estate or even having any control over it. She told her friend Kerry Radcliffe, "I think he's going to kill me," Shin said. He held up another picture of Cheryl, the last picture taken of her, a shockingly graphic photograph that showed how she looked on the night of September 21st, 1986. "She was beaten over 20 times," Shin said. No one would have recognized this battered corpse as the smiling woman in the first picture. The first witness was Randy Blyton, the young truck salesman who had seen Cheryl's van bumping against the median barrier and had bravely dashed across the Sunset Highway to get it out of harm's way and to save approaching motorists from disaster. He told of his shock when he saw the dead woman lying across the front seat. Karen Aborg was next. Brad had had so many women throughout his life that it wasn't surprising his brief affair with Karen Aborg had managed to escape the notice of the original investigating team in 1986. Karen had been in her early 20s when she worked for Brad at Citizens Savings and Loan, a young attorney fresh out of law school. Lilia Sarnan's affair with Brad had virtually overlapped his affair with Karen. Add to that the fact that he was simultaneously sleeping with his son's babysitter, and it was easy to see why just keeping up with his sexual conquests was a challenge for police investigators. Karen Aborg had simply slipped through the cracks. Karen had had some misgivings about Brad's activities in late September 1986, the time of his wife's murder, but she hadn't wanted to hold up her hand and say, "I was involved with Brad, too." In fact, she had been relieved when no one questioned her about him. She hadn't really known anything that would help the police anyway, but then Mike Shin's private investigator, Chick Preston, had discovered her relationship with Brad and seemed fascinated with her recollections. He urged her to talk to Shin, whose eyes lit up when she told him about events of the week after Cheryl died. Karen walked to the witness chair, a slender, almost girlish-looking woman, her golden hair swept back from her face and caught in a black ribbon. If she wore makeup at all, it was so lightly applied that it was invisible. Shin had noted that Karen was what seemed to be Brad's type. The same small features, the same symmetry and delicacy. And she was nervous. All of the women in Brad's life were nervous when they spoke of him, and most of all when they did so for the public record. Karen told the jury that she had been interviewed for the first time only about 10 days before this civil trial, when Chick Preston approached her. She had worked for Brad for a little less than a year at Citizens Savings and Loan in Lake Oswego, beginning in June or July 1985. An attorney, she was a loan closer, while Lilia Sarnen was a loan officer. She said she started going out with Brad in May or June 1986. "How long did you date him?" Shin asked.
"2 or 3 months."
"Were you in love with him?"
"No."
There was no emotion in Karen Aborg's voice. "Did you have an amicable parting?" She nodded. She and Brad, who was 15 years older than she was, had remained friends and had been in contact. "Do you remember when Cheryl Keaton was killed?"
"Yes. It was a Monday around lunchtime when I heard. One of our temps from Citizens called me and said a person named Cheryl Keaton had been killed, or found killed, and wasn't that Brad's wife?"
Karen didn't know Cheryl. She had met her once very briefly. She had immediately called Brad.
"I said, 'Hi, how are things going?' He said, 'Okay.' And I said, 'Brad, what's going on, really? I heard that Cheryl was dead.' And he said that, yes, that was what had happened."
He had told her that he was just leaving to go talk to an attorney. "This is the Monday following Cheryl's death?"
"Yes."
Karen testified that Brad had come to her apartment the next day, Tuesday, and talked to her about his movements on Sunday night. He showed up unexpectedly and spent an hour or so telling her what he had done on Sunday night in much detail. She repeated to the jury what Brad had told her. His story began very like the version he had told police about eating with Sarah and the boys in the pizza place. Then he had had trouble with bad gas or water in his gas tank with his Suburban. Brad told Karen that after he got back to the Madison Tower, he was supposed to return the boys to Cheryl. He said he called Cheryl to tell her he was having car trouble, but it was his impression that she was busy, that she had someone there and wasn't interested in talking with him.
He said she sounded mad at him. "Just leave her alone. She'd been drinking. She didn't care about getting the kids back." Then he decided the kids would stay with him that night.
But from that point, the version Brad had told Karen became a little different. He told her he had gone down to the parking garage to get the boys' backpacks, and especially Philip's blanket, and took Philip, not Michael, with him, leaving the two older boys in the apartment. He said he ran into Lilia Sarnen in the garage, and he also mentioned seeing a police officer in the garage. "Was this all in the same trip?" Shin asked.
"Yes, I think so. He said he got whatever he needed to get out of the car. He went back upstairs, the kids watched a movie, they fell asleep, and the next thing he knew, there was a police officer knocking on his door about midnight or 1 o'clock.
"Did he tell you that he had more than one conversation with Cheryl that night?"
"Yes, at least 2, maybe 3. I think what I remember is that Cheryl called him and suddenly wanted those kids, changed her tune, and wanted him to return those kids right now. I think he argued with her because it sounded like she was with somebody and had been drinking."
Karen had just cut a large hole in Brad's alibi for the night Cheryl was killed. He had told everyone else that he had been waiting for Cheryl to come and get their sons. He had never said that he refused to let the boys go home to her because she was drunk and had a man with her. He had made a big point of saying that he had gone out on the balcony to watch for Cheryl, but that she had never shown up.
Karen further testified that she had seen Brad several times that first week after the murder. She even took care of his boys while he was at his attorney's office. She kept them at different times for an hour or so. "Did he express to you his attitude about the police investigation that was going on?" Shin asked.
"Yeah. He said the DA in Washington County was really out to get him, that this guy had almost a vendetta against him."
"A vendetta?"
"Yeah. He said that he was convinced that Brad had done it, and that he was going to get him. Brad felt he was going to be arrested at any time."
"Did he express his attitude about Cheryl's mother?"
"Well, yeah. He was concerned that Cheryl's mother would get the kids."
"Did he ask you to do anything about that?"
"Yeah. He asked me to take the boys and get out of the state and just kind of keep them, get them out of town when things were very traumatic and he could get arrested at any time."
"Were you supposed to take them?"
"Out of the state, not out of the country. He didn't want to know where they were."
"Why?"
"Because if he was arrested, he didn't want to know where they were. If he was asked by authorities, he didn't want to know."
Karen said that Brad had given her $3,000 he took out of an account at First Interstate Bank. She went with him to get the money. She had kept the money for a day or two because she had tentatively agreed to help Brad hide his children. But then she changed her mind and returned the $3,000. Karen Aborg was finally excused. What would the jury think of a man who was willing to have his children spirited away so far that even he couldn't find them? They had just lost their mother, yet he had planned to hide them completely, delivering them to strangers somewhere. He had wanted to take them away from their mother, but he apparently had been willing to abandon them so that their grandmother could not have them, or so that they wouldn't be vulnerable to other enemies of Brad. As the trial progressed, still without Brad in attendance, Shin varied his witnesses, some from the past, some from the present, some from Cheryl's career world, some from her family and her social world, and some detectives and criminalists from the investigation of her murder. And gradually, the jury began to see the image of Brad's life psychopathology emerge. Another friend from work, Janet Blair, told of witnessing Cheryl's new will not long before her murder. "As we were witnessing the will, Cheryl said, 'I want this all taken care of so that if something happens on this trip, Brad will not get anything and the children will get everything.' And the other thing she said, and I will never forget this, is, 'If I'm ever found dead, Brad did it.'" Sharon McCulloch testified, and Cheryl's cousin, Katana King, and any number of women who had worked for Garvey, Schubert, and Bearer. They described a woman who had once had guts and strength and brilliance, but who had become so subdued that she lived in fear that her estranged husband was going to keep her children from her, even if he had to kill her to do it. All the women spoke in voices tremulous with tears. None of them had been able to save Cheryl. All of them had tried. Katana King testified in a voice so soft that the jurors had to strain to hear her. Cheryl had told her that Brad was at least 3 years behind in filing his income tax. A few weeks before Cheryl was killed, Katana said she had been alarmed when she listened to Cheryl speak on the phone to Brad. He was asking her to come and help him with his income taxes, and it made her angry. Cheryl said to him, "No way, I'm not going to help you. We're," meaning Brad's sister Ethel, "working against you, and I'm going to hang you for it." Brad said to her, "Well, I'm not going to worry about it anyway, because you're not going to be around to do anything." "When was the last time you saw Cheryl?" Shin asked.
"The last time," Katana said softly, "was on Saturday night at Cheryl's mother's house. She was very quiet, very quiet. She was very calm. We talked, and she took me home, and she said, 'You take care of yourself, Katana.' And I said, 'No, you take care of yourself.' And that was the last I ever saw her."
Chief Criminal Deputy DA Bob Herman was the next witness. He testified that after Cheryl's body was discovered in the van, he had accompanied OSP Detective Jerry Finch to her house on 81st Street. There they met her brother, Jim Carr, and the three of them went into the house. When they walked into the kitchen, Herman said, Jerry found a note on the drain board. Let me show you my client's exhibit too, Shin said, holding a blow-up of what Finch had found in Cheryl's kitchen. Herman read it aloud. I have gone to pick up the boys from Brad at the mobile station next to the IGA. If I'm not back, please come and find me. Come right away. Jim Carr had told Finch and Herman about the bitterness of his sister's divorce and her habit of taking notes on her conversations with Brad. Do you remember any evidence of alcoholic drinking? Shin asked Herman. Beverage glasses, wine glasses? Herman shook his head. The house was neat as a pin. Thank you. You may step down. Sarah Gordon took the witness stand to testify against her former husband. Almost 5 years earlier, she had been adamant that he was an innocent man hounded by the police. She had never lied. She was not a woman who could lie. But she had answered only those questions asked of her. Now, Sarah knew through bitter experience what kind of man lurked behind the charming facade she had fallen in love with, and she was prepared to tell the jurors about the real Brad Cunningham. Sarah was remarkably pretty and almost fragile in appearance. For her day on the witness stand, she wore a dark wine suit with a white blouse, and it was obvious that she was nervous, perhaps even frightened. It was also obvious that she was resolute. As the jurors listened, enthralled, Sarah relived her first meeting with Brad and all that had transpired between them since the spring of 1986. She had to open up her private life, reveal things that no woman would want to tell. It was terribly difficult for a woman of exceptional intelligence to have to admit that love had temporarily obliterated her common sense. She described how rapidly her affair with Brad had progressed. He made me feel very, very special. He spent a lot of time with me and involved me in the activities with his children. He seemed like a very successful business person to me. He was a lot of fun to be with. Brad had been every woman's ideal man at first, but he had soon revealed himself to be an opportunist, adulterer, thief, and stalking predator. He was also a liar and had convinced Sarah of a number of things that were not true, that Cheryl was a loose woman, that he had been designated the better parent by psychologists, that Cheryl and her mother had been plotting to poison him. He told me that he stopped eating at home unless he took one of the kids' plates or ate something that they hadn't finished, Sarah testified. He didn't eat until they had eaten it first. Mike Shin led Sarah through the events of September 21, 1986, when she had lent Brad her Toyota Cressida, the vehicle that Shin submitted was the car he had used when he ambushed Cheryl at the mobile station. That whole week had been strange. Brad's rage after Cheryl's deposition on September 16th, his phone threats to Cheryl that night, and the fight they had on the stormy night of September 19th when he and Sarah picked up the boys. Sarah said she was surprised at his rage and surprised how quickly it dissipated after he told Cheryl that he would make her pay. Shin asked Sarah when she had last seen Brad without clothing during the weekend of September 19th through the 21st. Friday night. Did he have any bruises on his upper body?
No.
After Sunday night, when was the first time you saw Mr. Cunningham without clothes on his upper body? Shin asked.
Wednesday or Thursday morning, we were taking a shower together.
Did you see anything on his body that you hadn't seen prior to Sunday night?
Yes, I saw a very large bruise under his arm, like huge. I can't remember if it was the right or left arm. It seems like the left, just the back of the upper arm. I remember being very shocked when I saw it, and gasping,
It was very large, like this size. She held her hands apart and demonstrated a circle the size of a cantaloupe. Sarah gave the jurors a precise time schedule for the night of Sunday, September 21st. She had said goodbye to Brad and the boys shortly before 7, she began. "When is the next time you actually heard from Mr. Cunningham?" Shin asked. "He called me at the hospital right at 7:30. He said that Cheryl was coming to the apartment to pick up the children." "When is the next time that you actually talked to Mr. Cunningham?" "That was at 9:10. "That was an hour and 20 minutes later?" "Yes." "What did you think he had been doing?" "At 8:50, when you finally got him on the phone, tell us what was said." "I asked him where he had been," Sarah said. "He said he had been waiting for Cheryl to pick the boys up. He sounded very escalated, very excited."
"Did he say anything about ever leaving the apartment?"
"I recall in my first conversation, I thought they were in the apartment. He said they were actually down in the lobby. The next day he started saying, no, Michael was with him. They were doing errands, getting the mail, taking shoes down to my car."
Shin asked Sarah how long such errands would have taken, the elevator ride and then the walk to the garage or the mailboxes.
5 minutes.
Sarah was no longer on Brad's side. She now had come to realize what kind of man he really was, and she was testifying to everything she remembered from the night of Cheryl's murder, knowing full well that the details she recalled did not mesh with Brad's explanations to the police or to Karen Aborg. She could understand now what Cheryl had lived through in the last months of her life. Sarah went on to describe how they had kept on the move the first week after Cheryl's murder, and how Jess, Michael, and Philip were taken out of state. Shin asked how long it was before she saw Brad and the three little boys again.
"They eventually came back, and I think they stayed with his aunt and uncle in Seattle, Herman and Trudy Dreesen."
"Were you in love with Mr. Cunningham by then?"
"Yes."
"When?"
"I was very committed to him and his children by that summer."
"You married him?"
"Yes, in November of 1987.
"You adopted his children?"
"Yes."
The testimony moved into the rapid deterioration of their marriage, the huge amounts of money Sarah had given Brad to finance his various ventures and expensive lifestyle, and the tremendous debts she had been saddled with when they separated and divorced. Nothing she had to say helped Brad's case. She no longer cared. She had been frightened when her testimony began, but as the hours passed, she seemed to experience a catharsis. She could almost see the humor in Brad's constant manipulation. She had been much more frightened during her marriage, and she had had to tell this same story in her deposition before the civil trial while Brad was sitting at the same table. Only his attorney, Joe Reiki, was between them then. Even though she faced away from Brad, she had been frightened. Today, he wasn't in the courtroom. No one knew where he was. Telling her story to Mike Shin and the jury was so much easier than what she had already been through, and she seemed to relax as her testimony drew to a close. "When did you file for divorce?" Shin asked.
March 7th, 1990.
And then Sarah recounted the terror she had lived through during their divorce. The threats and harassments, the sudden appearances and disappearances, the demands for money, the destruction of the Dunthorpe house, the stalkings. Now all that was in the past. Brad had cost her $1 million, but even that didn't matter. What mattered was that she hadn't seen the three boys she had legally adopted and had loved as her own for so long. Her sons were growing up without her. She didn't even know if they were safe living with a father who was capable of violent rages and physical abuse. "One final question," Michael Shin asked. "During that second phone call to Brad on September 21st, when you found him at home, what did you say to him?"
"I was angry. My first response was, 'When I can't get hold of you, I don't know if you're out killing Cheryl or Cheryl's killing you.'"
You were kidding, weren't you?
No, I was serious. I was really concerned. I didn't know where he was. It was so unlike him not to be in touch with me.
That relationship had reached such a peak where you were actually partway serious.
Yes.
What was his response?
He didn't respond.
Chapter 48. Dr. Karen Gunson, who had performed the autopsy on Cheryl, used photos during her testimony that showed the terrible damage done to the victim. Dr. William Brady, a legend in forensic pathology who had been Oregon State's medical examiner for more than 20 years, testified next. Tall, slim, and dapper, with a neatly trimmed snowy white mustache and Van Dyke beard, he had studied the Cheryl Keaton case at Shin's request. "Of all these autopsies and homicide investigations you've been involved in," Shin asked, "how would you rate the level of violence in the Cheryl Keaton case?"
"The amount of violence would certainly have to be at the top of my particular scale. Actual physical assaults or beatings are uncommon. Of those I have had experience with, they fall into two categories, a few blows, and the other narrow category of repetitive extreme violence, of what we call overkill. Of that now exceedingly small group, this one certainly, with the number of injuries, the distribution, character type of the injuries, would rank this right up at the top of anyone's scale."
Dr. Brady went over each injury and told the jury that there were minutes, quite some minutes, before Cheryl actually died. Her death had not been instantaneous. She may well have been alive for a good time after 8 o'clock.
"As much as 20 minutes or 30 minutes? Shin asked.
"That's not unreasonable. Probably less, but it may have been that long."
"So we have 15 or 30 minutes of beating?"
"I certainly wouldn't want to suggest that the beating occurred all that time, because we have motion, a change of location of the automobile.
For some reason," Shin said, "there's a lull, and there's more beatings?"
"What we can say medically is that there is a period of survival during which time this lady had been beaten, lived, and died. We're not talking about a single beating and then death, no."
"It's not a merciful killing, was it?"
"That's an understatement."
Based on his experience, Dr. Brady said that this particular type of overkill was a crime of passion.
Dr. Russell Sardo, who had attempted to find some equitable way for Brad and Cheryl to share their custody of their three little boys, testified to his finding that, in the end, he had chosen Cheryl as the primary parent. Dr. Sardo was on the stand for a long time, and he did an excellent job of explaining the dynamics he had seen between Cheryl and Brad, his aggression and her willingness to bend as far as she could to reach some kind of a solution. He commented that often divorcing parents view children as possessions, something to be won from the other party like a house or a car or a boat. Although that was not true in Cheryl's case, it was in Brad's. Lieutenant Rod Englert of the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office was a much sought-after expert in a somewhat arcane area of expertise, blood spatter evidence. He could read all manner of things from blood spatter, splatter, spray, drops, and stains. He could actually reconstruct crime scenes showing direction of force, and he could decipher whether blood spatter was of low, medium, or high velocity. He was also an expert on crime scene psychology. Englert had viewed the evidence from the Keaton homicide. In his psychological reconstruction of Cheryl's murder, Englert first considered what type of person might carry out the overkill of 24 violent blows. Then he tried to connect a sequence of events that had taken place inside the Toyota van. Englert began, We have four different motives to consider. Was it a fear thing? Was it revenge? Was it sex? Or was it theft? Most homicides fall into one of those categories. In crimes of violence, blood is often shed, and through that bloodshed you can make interpretations. Englert showed the jury that round drops are usually low-velocity spatter, cast-off blood. If a person's hand is bleeding, or if the weapon in the hand of a killer has blood on it and he throws it back, the blood will be cast off onto a surface in an elongated shape with a tail. The tail always points toward the direction of travel. Medium-velocity impact spatter is blood shed by blunt trauma. If I hit Mr. Shin with a baseball bat, Englert said, there will be no blood from the first blow. There will be a laceration. He moved his arm to demonstrate, and Shin never flinched. The jury watched, fascinated. The second blow, or even the third, will produce medium-velocity spatter. As a result of my striking Mr. Shin with this baseball bat, we start creating a spatter pattern, and I can hit him 10 or 15 times, and you'll see a horribly bloody scene. But you can look at me, and you could swear I didn't do it because there will be very little blood on the perpetrator. There may be some on my shoes, there may be some right here under my cuffs. There may be some on the back of my hand, but very, very little. The force is away from the person doing the striking. In Cheryl's murder, there would have been massive amounts of blood around where her head had been, but virtually no blood on the person who struck those blows. Englert had selected 11 photographs of the Toyota van to show the jury what had happened to her. In my opinion, the first time she was hit was in the driver's seat. You say there's no blood in the driver's seat, but that's why. The blood was directed away from the driver's seat. Most of the blows are to the left side of her body and to the back of her head. The first blow wouldn't have shed any blood, but the next blow... Englert pointed to the child's car seat behind the driver's seat. The tails of blood were there, pointing to the rear of the van, away from the direction of blows. She was in the driver's seat, her head leaning toward the passenger seat. There were defensive bruises on her arm where she tried to ward off the blows. That's position number one. Position number two was on the console between the seats. She's down, she's bloody, she's moving her hands and transferring blood, cloth on cloth, Cheryl's shirt moving against the upholstery, and struggling. Her only route of escape is toward the passenger door. Cheryl was hit so many times that she was weakening. This was chilling testimony. The courtroom was absolutely still, save for Englert's voice. Position number three, he demonstrated, was where most of the damage was done to the back of Cheryl's head. She was down, disoriented. She was stretching for the door, but her head was at the headrest. The medium-velocity spatter showed on the passenger window. At this point, Englert felt that Cheryl was rendered unconscious. She was struggling, but slowly, to get out the door before this. See the low-velocity blood where she rested. The tails are pointed downward on the back of the seat, as they would as if from a nosebleed. She also tried to open the door to escape. There's medium-velocity spatter on the inside of this door jamb, and it couldn't have gotten there unless the door was open. There was only one more position, position number four. Her buttocks were on the console, her head is down and stationary, and she's bleeding, saturating blood into the carpet on the passenger floor. Englert held a photograph of the plastic bag found on the floor of the passenger side. There were transfer blood stains there from Cheryl's hair, but there was no movement at all. Englert agreed with Dr. Brady that it had taken many minutes for the attack to take place. Cheryl had bled for a long time. If I understand you correctly, Shin said, the blood spatter trail that you can read for us is more reliable than if we'd had an eyewitness in this case.
It's scientific, Englert said. It's reliable, as opposed to witnesses sometimes, who are not as reliable, including myself.
What kind of weapon was used?
It's a linear object. Englert picked up a long police flashlight, a Kell light that Shin had procured. The murder weapon, he said, would have been something similar with many different shaped surfaces. The blood on the ceiling of the van was cast-off blood flung from the blunt object used to bludgeon Cheryl to death as her killer hit her again and again. Shin asked Englert what he felt was the motive for this murder. Englert wrote four words on the easel and crossed them out one by one. Sex? No. Theft? No. Because this is what I would term overkill. This is one of the very few that you'll see with that much overkill. Englert said if he had been there on the night of the murder, he would have ruled out everything but fear and revenge. The fact that the van had been rolled out onto the freeway, combined with the overkill, made him believe the motive was revenge. You can just see the hatred in this case, Lieutenant Englert commented, because of the four different positions I described to you. You see a male who has a very strong personality, a very domineering personality. He wouldn't be afraid. Both Oregon State Police Sergeant Greg Baxter and Detective Jim Ayers had always believed that Brad had taken his 4-year-old son Michael along with him when he went to confront Cheryl at the mobile station. You mean her own son was used as bait to lure her to her death? Mike Shin asked Baxter when he took the stand. That's exactly correct. Ayers testified next. He had worked closely with Shin in reconstructing this case. When he took the stand, he was as anxious as the people who had known Cheryl Keaton in life to see that her killer was brought to justice. Nobody ever knew what Ayers was going to look like. He worked undercover as much as he did routine detective work. He sometimes looked like an accountant, but just as frequently he would resemble a truck driver or a bearded biker. Even those who knew him well could often stand right next to him and fail to recognize him. He was extremely proficient on any detail, be it drug enforcement, sex crimes, or homicide, and he was a natural chameleon. On the day of his testimony, his hair was cut short, and he wore horn-rimmed glasses. He was dressed in a striped shirt, dark suit, and tie. He was, for the moment, in his accountant garb. Ayers told the jurors that when he and Detective Jerry Finch went to Brad's Madison Tower apartment a few hours after his wife had been found dead, they were there only to inform him of her death. There had been no reason to read Brad his rights under Miranda. He was not a suspect. He wasn't in custody. When you first got to Mr. Cunningham's apartment, Shin began, you didn't know anything about him or about her, did you? No. Other than that she was dead, Ayers said. Ayers recalled the 1-hour-and-50-minute conversation he had had that night with Brad. It was to be the last time Brad would ever talk to him about anything. After that, he had made himself unavailable to the investigators. I asked him about the last time that he had seen Cheryl, Ayers said, and he stated he had seen her Friday evening when he had picked the kids up. Ayers testified that Brad told him Cheryl had agreed to come to his apartment and pick up the boys. When Ayers said he had information that Brad had planned to meet Cheryl at the abandoned mobile station on the West Slope, he denied it. What was the next conversation? I asked him if he'd killed Cheryl. What'd he say? He said no. How'd he say it? He had a very brief display of emotion, and I mean brief, a 15-to-20-second display of emotion. My interpretation of what that wasn't emotion over Cheryl having been killed, but he was frightened by the fact that I had asked him that question. Ayers repeated Brad's oft-told stories about Cheryl's affairs with a number of men and her fondness for country and western music.
He said that she hung out at a truck stop and often went to the nude beach on the Columbia River. At that point in the investigation, Ayers said he had no reason to doubt Brad's description. Later, he said he had discovered that Brad had been lying, and he saw it as an attempt to suggest that any number of people might have had a motive to murder Cheryl. "Did he say he ever left the apartment?" Shin asked. "Yes, he did," Ayers testified. "He said he left one time just long enough to take some things down to the garage because he had an inspection to do the next day." "Did he tell you that he and the three little boys were sitting in the lobby for a long time waiting for Cheryl to show up?" "No." "Did he tell you that he took Michael with him for a while, wearing his jogging costume and his hunting jacket?" "No. I asked Cunningham if he was athletic," Ayers said. He stated, "No."
"He denied he was athletic?"
"Yes."
Shin reminded Ayers and the jury of Brad's background as a star football player, and whoever had killed Cheryl had probably been someone of considerable strength and almost certainly jogged from the crime scene to the mobile station to get his car. Beyond Jim Carr's suspicions, Ayers had no reason to believe that Brad was lying. In retrospect, however, it seemed that he was denying anything that might have linked him to Cheryl's murder, and he would not have done that unless he already knew how the crime had been committed. Ayers testified that at one point Finch had asked if he could talk to the boys. "Cunningham just said, 'No, not until I talk to an attorney about it.'"
"Why did you want to talk to the boys?"
"My strong suspicion," Ayers said, "and greatest fear, was that all, or at least one of those children, were with Brad Cunningham."
Suddenly, Ayers' voice faltered and he closed his eyes against tears, swallowing hard. He couldn't speak. Judge Haggerty realized that, for the moment, Ayers could not go on. He called for a noon recess. And when court reconvened that afternoon, the jury listened to other witnesses before Ayers returned to the stand. He had regained his composure and was able to continue his testimony in his usual professional voice.
"I had substantial concern, that was shared by all the investigators in this case, that Brad had taken at least one or all the boys with him, that one or more of those boys might have been a witness to their mother's death."
"He never let you talk to those boys?" Shin asked.
"No, not willingly."
"Eventually you had to subpoena them," Shin said, "and they had a lawyer by then. Is it common for little children to have a lawyer when their father is a murder suspect?"
"I've never encountered it."
In fact, 6-year-old Jess had offered testimony to a grand jury that implied his father had been absent from the Madison Tower apartment at the time of his mother's murder. But that had not been enough to indict Brad for the crime, and no one investigating the case had been able to speak to the boys again. When Jim Ayers stepped down from the witness chair, he hoped his testimony would help to nail Brad Cunningham. For years he had wanted to face Cunningham in a court of law. Brad was not there now, but it didn't matter. The jury could still render its verdict. If it ruled against him, Cunningham could eventually face a criminal trial, and Ayers would willingly take the witness stand again.
Chapter 49. Ordinarily, the family of the defendant testifies for the defense. In this trial, there was no defense, only an empty table. But had there been a defense, the female relatives from Brad's past would not have testified for him. They came to Judge Haggerty's courtroom to testify for Cheryl's estate. Ethel Cunningham Bakey, Brad's elder sister, wore a white pantsuit and a dark aqua blouse. She was blonde with dark brown eyes and bore a resemblance to her brother. "Brad was so suave and so sweet talking with the girls," she testified. "He made money. He knew how to turn a dollar."
"Did you know his wives?" Shin asked.
"Yes. I met Lonnie Ann because she was my babysitter when he was in high school.
I met Cynthia because I went to court to help Lonnie Ann keep her children, and I ran into my brother in a restaurant, and I met Lauren, who was about to have her baby. They separated within a month after that, and Cheryl came into his life. My daughter got married on June 28, 1986, and my father said, "Have you called Cheryl?" And I said, "I don't know Brad's address or phone number."
Sanford Cunningham had told Ethel that Cheryl and Brad were having problems and that she could be nice and invite Cheryl to the wedding.
"Did you call Cheryl?" Shin asked.
"I did. This was in April. I invited her to the wedding, and she said, 'I would like to know more about you and your mother.' I said, 'My mom's alive,' and she said, 'You're kidding.' And I said she would be at the wedding."
Cheryl told Ethel that she was very afraid of Brad and that he had threatened her.
"You're not the first," Ethel answered.
And so a friendship had developed, and Cheryl, her brother, and her three boys all came to Ethel's daughter's wedding. Sanford, who had less than a month to live, came to the wedding too.
"That was the first time I had seen my dad in all this time," Ethel said. "My dad then died on July 26th. Cheryl called me after the funeral and told me she felt partly responsible for my dad's heart attack, and that Brad had told her not to come to the funeral. I told her Brad had shown up with Sarah and tried to pass her off as Cheryl. I nipped that in the bud."
Shin asked Ethel about her relationship with Cheryl later that summer. "Did she talk with you about witnesses?"
"Yes."
"Did she talk to you about who they were?"
"Yes."
"In the conversation Cheryl had with you about taxes and bankruptcy, what did she tell you in connection with the evidence she intended to present in the divorce and custody proceedings?"
"She was going to break Brad. Break the bankruptcy statements. She was going to prove that he was getting money. He was avoiding taxes with the IRS. I gave her any information she needed. She told me she had prepared a list. She was keeping it secret."
"Did you have conversations with her?" Shin asked, "where she was afraid of the consequences?"
"Not only was she afraid of the consequences to her, but to those of us who were going to testify. She made a list, but it was a protective kind of list. She told me that on the Friday before her death."
It was clear from Ethel's testimony that she believed her brother was capable of violence, of revenge, of murder. She said he had beaten her, too. Shin elicited testimony from Ethel about her final conversation with Cheryl. It had been on Friday, September 19, 1986, after Brad picked up the children. Cheryl said they had argued as usual, and she had insisted he have the boys home on time on Sunday because they had school the next morning.
"They'd started to argue and fight," Ethel said, "and he was raising his arms and everything, and all of a sudden he stopped and said, 'What's the matter with me? Sunday? You're not going to be here after Sunday. I don't have to worry about you.' I sat right up and said, 'Cheryl, Cheryl, he's not just making threats anymore. He means to do it this weekend. He's got a plan. I know Bradley. He doesn't have to argue with you because it's settled in his mind. He's going to do it.' I even tried to warn her. I said, 'Cheryl, listen to me. He's not going to attack you in your house. Has he ever threatened you with the children being harmed if you don't do what he tells you to?' And she said, 'Yes. I'd lay down my life for my kids, you know that.'"
Sobbing on the stand, Ethel recalled that she had warned Cheryl that Brad was going to do something to call her out of her home, alone, tell her that something was wrong so she would have to go out to get the kids, that he would draw her away from security.
"How did you know this?" Shin asked.
"He plans and he creates, and he figures out how he's going to go after somebody," Ethel said. "He was this way in junior high."
Rosemary Kinney, Brad's mother, took the stand next. She looked nothing like snapshots of the lovely young girl Sanford had married or the attractive middle-aged woman standing next to him on a camping trip. The years had been unkind to her.
Her hair was still raven black, but it was pulled into a knot on top of her head, and her face was deeply lined, her eyes almost hidden by pouches of flesh. Shin asked her what the nature of her relationship with Brad had been over the previous decade.
"I haven't seen my son," Rosemary said, the pain of many losses bringing tears to her eyes. "I saw him at his father's funeral in July. Before that, it had to be at Lonnie Ann's custody hearing."
"You testified against your son?"
"Yes, I did, of his treatment of the children. He came to the cabin with the children, and I had fixed dinner. He dished their plates up, they were small, and he walked into the kitchen and said, 'Eat that food.' Kate said she couldn't eat any more. He started force-feeding them. Kate finally vomited her food into her plate."
"Did you know Mr. Cunningham's second wife?"
"Only time I seen her was in court. She was quite a bit older than Brad."
"His third wife, Lauren Swanson?"
"No, I didn't know her. I got a glimpse of her one time. Lonnie Ann was going to let me have the children one weekend because Brad would never let me see them. I went to Lonnie Ann's mother's house, and I put my car behind the house so Brad wouldn't see it. They drove up, and I got a glimpse."
"Were you invited to their wedding?" Rosemary looked astonished.
"To Brad's wedding? No."
Rosemary told of the first time she ever met Cheryl Keaton. Kate had given her Cheryl's address, and she wrote a letter to explain who I was and my nationality. "I'm a registered member of the Colville Confederated Tribe, and I'm French, Indian, English, Hawaiian. I knew Cheryl probably didn't know anything about me, and I wanted her to realize that Brad did have a mother, and I did care about the children. When she got my letter, she called me. It was really wonderful to get to talk to her." Rosemary had finally met Cheryl at Ethel's daughter's wedding in June 1986.
"I was standing in the church, and this pretty lady came up in front of me with these three beautiful boys, and she said, 'This is your grandmother,' and these little boys gave me a hug."
Rosemary put her head in her hand and sobbed. She had never even hoped that she would meet Cheryl or her youngest grandsons. She got a chance to visit with Cheryl at the reception and to have her picture taken with her and the boys.
"I told Cheryl, 'I'll tell you one thing. Don't ever trust Brad.'"
"Why do you say that?" Shin asked.
"Well, after my first husband left me, I got a job as a teacher's aide in Eastern Washington, and it was a break from school, and I came home because I still had the house. I'd changed the lock so no one could get in. I drove up, and there was lights on, and I went in, and my son was there. There was this woman, Brad's second wife. He said he was there to get his things. We had words. He hit me and knocked me on the floor. I tried to get up, and every time I tried, he hit me again. Finally, he went out the door, and every time I tried to go out, he hit me with the screen door. He finally hit me so hard in the chest with his arm and fist, I landed out in front of the house on my neck and shoulders. I went to the neighbors and called the sheriff."
When the deputy arrived, Rosemary said Brad came charging in and said,
"I'm the one that called you."
But the deputy didn't believe him. He waited until Brad had removed some things he had in his mother's garage and left the house.
"The following Monday, I went to Roxbury Court and filed charges against my son," Rosemary said, beginning to cry again. "I figured that if I filed charges against him, he would never do anything like this to anybody else. I knew he had been cruel with Lonnie Ann, so I filed the charges. The day he was supposed to go to court, I was there, but Brad had an attorney. The judge said Brad wouldn't be there. I had to leave to go back to work. Nothing ever happened about that."
Rosemary went on to tell the jury that she had been afraid of Brad, her own son, ever since he was in high school. Shin handed her a letter that Brad had once sent to her. It was remarkably similar to the letter he would send to Sarah and to any number of women who had angered him. He warned her that, if she didn't change her ways, she might end up killing someone. Like her daughter Ethel, Rosemary testified that she would have done anything in the world to help Cheryl keep her children. In the end, of course, there was nothing they could do. The protective witness list that Cheryl had drawn up, the battle plan that she believed would bring Brad down and protect her little boys, had been as fragile as a cobweb held up against a bazooka. Lonnie Ann Cunningham testified through her videotape deposition. Her taut, pale little face filled the screen, and the jurors listened as she recalled the horrors of her marriage to Brad. Kate Cunningham testified by phone. In a flat voice, she told about the spring she had spent in Houston when she was 12 or 13 and had been humiliated and held captive by her father. One overwhelming fact was becoming obvious. The women in Brad Cunningham's life had been disposable, dispensable, the objects of derision and hatred, and ultimately expendable. Even his wives, even his daughter, even his sisters, even his mother. The civil trial went on. There were no objections. There was no one there to object. A long line of Cheryl's friends and former law partners walked to the witness stand and spoke briefly of their memories of her. In that courtroom, Cheryl came to life, and the jurors began to sense the enormity of her loss. Stu Hennessy, Cheryl's friend from her early days at Garvey, Schubert & Bear, attempted to sum up what a superb lawyer she had been. Cheryl was clearly the best. As the pressure grew, she just got better and better. He also recalled Brad's possessions. "Brad really liked Mercedes Benzes," he said. "He almost always had two or three at a time." Hennessy described the Unimag as a huge moon buggy with tires 6 to 7 feet high, a vehicle used by the Israeli army to move troops. "Brad told me he had the only Unimag in the United States. It had absolutely no purpose as a car." "What about a yacht?" Shin asked. Hennessy remembered that Brad had acquired a yacht early in his marriage to Cheryl in trade for some project. As he recalled, Brad was renting it out for charters. "Did he have a police car?" Shin asked. "Yes," Hennessy said. "That was a source of great frustration to Cheryl. Brad got in his mind that he wanted a police car like the state patrols in Washington, the big white highway cruisers. They don't sell those to regular people, but Brad wanted one. He bugged some dealer until finally, it took months, they ordered him one. Poor Cheryl would have to drive this thing. It's like you don't have any springs. It's really a horrible car. There's nothing inside it. You know, it was kind of scary. It was white, except that it didn't have a light on the top. It was just like a police car." "You know what he used it for?"
"I haven't a clue."
"How would you describe Mr. Cunningham physically?"
"He wasn't a huge guy, but he was powerfully built," Hennessy said. "He told me he had to have all his shirts custom made because his neck was so big."
Cheryl's family, Betty and Marv Trosseth, Susan Keegan, and Bob McNanny, had told their last memories of Cheryl to the initial investigators. They testified now in the civil trial, old griefs coming back sharply. And they were prepared to testify again and again and again, if need be. There were no surprises in their testimony, nothing the Oregon State Police detectives and the Washington County DA's office hadn't heard back in 1986. Jim Carr, Cheryl's half-brother, identified Exhibit 6, the protective witness list that Cheryl had prepared, the list meant to fight Brad, but which had probably been Cheryl's death warrant. Mike Shin read it aloud while Carr nodded. It included Brad's mother and elder sister, two of his former wives, babysitters, and Cheryl's family, friends, and colleagues,
all people who would have been able to demonstrate Brad's pattern of abusive behavior. Sarah Gordon's sister Margie Johnson was the Megabuck spokesperson for the Oregon Lottery, and her face was well known to Oregon television viewers. She was as vivacious on the witness stand as she was on the small screen, a pretty, bubbly woman. She said that when U.S. Bank bought out Brad's contract shortly after Cheryl's murder, they asked for the return of all the pool cars he had borrowed. One was in Seattle, and she said that she had driven Brad to SeaTac Airport so he could drive it back. She had found Brad a nice person, but she barely knew him. Her sister Sarah had only been dating him for a few months.
"He was very upset," she testified. "Even though he hadn't done it, the murder would put a cloud over the bank."
Margie had also heard yet another version of Brad's movements on September 21, 1986.
"He said that they waited in the lobby. I was under the assumption that Cheryl was supposed to pick up the kids about 7 o'clock, and he had the kids in the lobby."
"Did you know she had been unwilling for months to come there to pick up those kids?" Shin cut in.
"No. He said when she didn't show up, they went back upstairs. Jess and Philip were watching a movie, and he was with Michael, and they went to check the mail."
According to the testimony of various witnesses, Brad had given many different versions of what he had done between 7:30 and 8:50 on the night Cheryl was murdered. He told Jim Ayers he had left his apartment just once to put shoes and work clothes in Sarah's Cressida. He first told Sarah that he and the boys had been in the lobby waiting for Cheryl to come for them. A day after the murder, he told her he had been doing errands, picking up mail, leaving his boots in her car. Brad told Karen Aborg that he had refused to let Cheryl have the boys at all that night because she was drunk and with a man, and that he had gone to the car with Philip to get the boys' blankets and backpacks. Lilia Sarnan saw Brad and Michael at 7:30, but Brad called her the next morning and tried to get her to say she had seen him at 8. Margie Johnson, Sarah's sister, had heard the waiting in the lobby story and that Brad and Michael were doing errands around the Madison Tower. Jess Cunningham remembered that his father said he had been jogging around Sarah's hospital and that he had been gone for a long time. Rachel Houghton saw Brad and a little boy in the garage around 9, and Brad had been wearing shorts and his hair was wet. Where was Brad during that hour and 20 minutes? Was he in his apartment, waiting in the lobby, watching for Cheryl from the rail around the walkway, doing errands all around the building, jogging, settling the boys down for the night? Or was he following a carefully thought-out plan to lure Cheryl to the deserted mobile station and her brutal death? Were his car problems a pretense? Had he selected the weapon he would use? Had he provided himself with a change of clothing? If this was a crime of revenge, as Lieutenant Englert had testified, was it also a crime of deliberate premeditation? It was certainly beginning to look that way. Chapter 50. Mike Shin called Dr. Ron Turco. A compactly muscled man with a thick head of hair, Turco looked younger than his age and nothing at all like a psychiatrist. "What is your profession?" Shin asked. "I'm a physician and I specialize in the practice of psychiatry," Turco replied. "The medical model of psychiatry, which views early development and early training as being very important in later behavior."